I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move
it. Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Like To Movie Movie. My name is Dan Scully.
My name is Steven Richards.
And we're back, baby.
This is weird.
This is weird because we're recording in person for the first time in a long time.
Yeah.
After our short season break. So thank you to everybody who stuck with us through those trying times. Thanks to everybody who listened to my dispatches from the Fantastic Fest. And of course, thank you to Alamo Drafthouse and Fantastic Fest for a wonderful time.
And thanks to Alamo Drafthouse for sponsoring this episode.
Yes, along with...
They don't know it yet.
They don't know it yet. Yeah. They also haven't given us any money towards
it. Nope.
But the fact that they gave me a free pass to their festival, I guess, counts as a form of payment. I will be writing it off.
Yeah, you should.
That's all that matters.
I still got to do my taxes for this year.
Jesus, what are you doing?
I got an extension. I have this weekend to do it.
Jeez, are you going to do it, though?
Yeah.
I didn't know you could do an extension.
Yeah, you can do extension, and I didn't want to do taxes back in April.
Yeah, it sucks. Yeah. The fact that you don't even know when tax season is says a whole lot about the situation.
But we're not here to talk about taxes.
No, we're not going to talk about taxes. This is our Halloween episode, the first episode of season two.
Well,
the first season was about 12 years long.
Yeah.
And, no, I guess there was a season break after Garrett passed, and then we're on season two, so this will be season three.
Yeah. And season five of Hot Property, our other show, which you can find at Hot Property Pod.
Hot Property Pod on all the things, and of course you can find this at Movie Movie Cast on all of the things. Yeah. This is our Halloween episode, and the first time that we're ever doing a Redux episode. The very first episode of I Like To Movie Movie, many, many moons ago, me and the dearly departed Garrett covered The Shining. And we're doing The Shining again. We're revisiting The Shining for a couple reasons. One, because it's a movie that revisits rather nicely and redefines itself with the passage of time. And two, much like my previous co-host... I am now hosting with somebody who's not very into horror movies, generally.
Yes.
And as we know, Garrett went from not digging horror movies to really becoming a big fan. And I'm hoping to do the same to you.
If I can get to tolerant, I'll consider your gambit a success.
Okay. I mean, what is it about horror movies that you are intolerant of?
When I go to the movies, I want to escape.
Okay.
And
your life is a horror movie?
No, it's just there's so much shit that is worth being fearful about that when I go to the movies, I want fun times to be had by all.
So we're removing the bell.
Yes, we're doing some quick audio level adjustments with the collar. Doris guest starring. But no, it's something about just being... Also, I like being tantalized, but it's like, I don't like feeling constant dread.
Okay.
And that's what most horror movies...
What is it that you dread about horror movies, though? Like, are you dreading the jump scare that's coming? Are you dreading a plot development? Are you dreading some thematic concern that might tie to you? Or is it just like the general vibe of the movie is not doing it?
Honestly, it's been so long since I've sat down and watched a horror movie. It's been about... 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Before that,
off the dome, can you remember what the last like horror movie you sat down and watched to end would be?
Beginning to end, no. But I know that... So my friend Kira is big into horror. You've met Kira before.
Yeah, yeah.
She... Whenever I go to her house, she has one of a Scream or a Halloween on in the background. So I've seen most of... Like, the new Halloweens, just not in order. Just like, this is actually what I described to you as my viewings of The Shining before this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a Christmas story. Seen it, just not in the order they want me to.
Honestly, with Halloween, the order has become irrelevant.
Oh, that is,
because the canon is all over the place.
You can jump in and out like the fucking city
Miramax
bus with that
just
one.
Bought Halloween.
Yeah.
And so now they're doing a TV show, and I hope to God... that they once again abandon canon and then just pick select items from canon to make the new canon, because now the only canonical thing about Halloween is that every new entry divorces itself from some segment of the canon, and I love it. It's delicious.
Sometimes, you know, that's the way to go.
Fair enough.
I wish Marvel did that.
Yeah, oh my god. I've heard that Loki is, like, not great this season.
I don't
care.
And
it's because they're like, yeah, I think I'm done.
I don't care.
I think I'm done.
I've been done for a while.
Meanwhile, I'm rewatching all of the Halloweens again currently, because I do that every year for some reason. But yeah,
I think Quantumania did it for me. Yeah. So, anyway.
No, Secret Invasion knocked me out.
I didn't even watch. I didn't even get there.
Oh my god, it was trash. It was trash!
But I think, to your point, it's probably worth revisiting while we do this, exploring why in the moment I don't like horror movies.
Now, did you like The Shining?
Yeah, but I wouldn't really call it a horror movie for a couple reasons. One, it's not very scary.
Okay.
Two, it's been such a staple of pop culture that a lot of the key scenes have been, as you commented while we were watching, like, memed out or I've seen when the Blu-ray started skipping during the famous "Here's Johnny" scene.
Yeah,
and you went to go fix it. Like, dude, I've seen this fucking scene a million times.
Yeah,
but, and like, you fought to be the purist and put it back on, which I appreciate.
Damn straight.
Because, you know, while I have seen that scene millions of times over the years, it is good to see it in the context it was originally meant to be seen in.
I was wildly familiar with "Here's Johnny" for decades before I ever saw The Shining, just because it's like part of the fabric. Yeah. So then my question then is, because you said this movie's not particularly scary, I think this movie is shit your pants horrifying. So my question is, what in a horror movie does scare you?
Well, so this brings...
Or what do you define as scary? Because that's kind of broad across lots
of
people.
Yeah. I'll get to that in a second, but I do want to point out that I think that, to pull the curtain back for a moment, and we'll get to this at some point during this episode, but you asked me to watch Room 237 before we watched The Shining, and I did. I watched it this morning, really cut under the wire on that one, as I am wont to do. And
you did bang out Warrior in the exact runtime amount of time before our start time of the episode.
But I was there.
It was brilliantly done. You pulled it off, and it was a great episode. It was brilliantly done.
But I think watching that also kind of set the table for me in a way where it wasn't. I knew what I was walking into a lot of the time. I knew the scenes they were talking about as they showed up in our viewing now.
Like, nothing's going to shock you. Nothing. You already know what's coming.
I've seen it analyzed by 8 different people at least before I watch it. And I think that if we were to redo it, I would probably watch it afterwards and see what my reaction would be in the moment. Because while I was watching it, I wasn't so much watching the movie. I was watching to see if I agreed with what they said in the documentary.
Yeah. Well, that's why I said watch Room 237 first, because you had kind of seen The Shining, so there was no way to go into it pure. That wasn't going to happen. And with Room 237, at least you then go in with your neurons firing.
And they were.
Saying, like, oh, you know, like, what can I pull out of this and all that. And I do think that you're onto something with the idea of, like, a movie is scarier the first time.
Yeah.
For the most part, because it still has the ability to surprise. But to me, that's like, I like when a movie can scare on repeat viewings because it sits with you. Because, like, something can be shrieky in the moment. Ah, boom! Oh, it was just Boots, the cat. Oh, he ran across the piano. You know, like, that kind of stuff, it jolts you in the moment. Yeah. But, like, what scares me is, like, I will think about what It Follows is about and be paralyzed. You know, because it sticks with me on a thematic level, this movie that is about growing up, in my estimation.
Yeah.
And The Shining, and we'll get into it because I have some questions asked. We'll get into, like, what I think it's about. You know, there's images in it that I find frightening. There's a general tone to it that I find unsettling when I watch it, which is frightening. But the idea of, like, what I ultimately think it's thematically about is something that I personally struggle with. So it really, really scares me in that sense when I think about it more. And to me, that's where I end up loving horror, is because horror is a fun house to watch. You know, you can watch Return of the Living Dead and go, oh, man, he's eating his brains. Oh, you know, like, love all that shit. But it's like, if it can hold up to second, third, fourth viewing and get past the shocks and still be fun, entertaining, or upsetting, or stick with you. That, to me, is how I define scary. Because, like recently a movie came out called Talk to Me. Talk to Me scared the fucking shit out of me. Absolutely horrifying movie. The first time I watched it, jumping out of my seat, freaked out by it. And then the reason why
that's
that
A24,
movie...
That's A24, right?
Yeah, A24. Yeah. They, like, snapped it up out of Sundance fast, and I can see why. It's terrifying. And then I went to watch it a second time to see if it was still scary in, you know, in a deeper sense than just, you know, I saw it at Overlooks. It was a great festival thing. The theater's shrieking.
That's the name of the hotel.
Yes. Well, yeah. At the Overlook Film Festival, say, which actually used to be in Colorado, but they moved to...
Is that why they named it that?
Yeah. Everything's that makes Shining themed.
Wow. That makes a lot of sense, Dan.
But the second
That's
time...
That's a good name for a horror
it's
film
It's a great
fest.
Name for a horror
Holy
film festival.
Holy shit.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And but the second time watching Talk to Me... It was then after the movie ended that I started thinking about it and getting the willies. And then I was able to say, this movie is scary. So I guess it's a tall ask as someone who doesn't dig horror for me to make you watch movies twice to see if they're actually scary. But I don't know. I still don't know if I fully understand what you find scary in a movie.
So can I spoil what our next episode is going to be?
Because yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's going to be where we hit our stride with our with how we're going to start this process.
Yeah.
Which is Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
Which I have no idea what it's about, how it connects to this, and I don't want to know.
Mm.
I want to go in as naked as I possibly can.
We'll let you go in blind.
Yeah.
Room 238. You got to watch it. It's going to be all about...
Well, I can't talk about room 235. So. But I think that there's a couple of like instances in other movies I can think of where I was like actually horrified.
Yeah.
And they both involved Joe Pesci.
Okay. What are they? I'm
Do you want to guess now that I've said that?
Because
one is very obvious.
One of them is like scares you.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it's something to do with Goodfellas.
It's either Goodfellas.
Because he scares
or
me in
Casino.
Goodfellas. Like the scene where he kills Samuel L. Jackson in Goodfellas actually upsets me in a way that scares me because it shows how like just unhinged he is.
No, so he's in one he's the perpetrator and the other he's the victim.
Well, in Casino he gets beaten to death with a baseball bat. That's when he's a victim.
Well, is that
in
don't they kill
he
his brother
executed.
Too?
Yeah, they beat his brother.
So that's
to death
the scene I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That scene fucks me
Terrifying.
Up because. Watching somebody that I love get beaten to death and buried alive while I am I'm next
yeah.
and they force me to watch
most horrifying
that is for me top tier S level holy fuck I'm terrified
that's one
shit.
Of the most upsetting
yeah.
scenes in a movie I've ever seen
and then the other one is when he's knocking that guy's eyes out with the vice
oh that's also Casino
yeah okay
you know what freaks me out about that scene
so that's why I haven't seen Casino
he pops his eye out with the vice but he also talks in the narration. About how this guy was the toughest Mick that I ever came across. We did this, we did that. We put ice picks through his balls, and then I had to squeeze his fucking out. They put ice picks through his balls.
Yeah.
They didn't show that, but that is horrifying. And that nothing freaks me out more than when someone's begging you to kill them, which that guy does.
Yeah, and then a couple of other items just came to mind that we're talking about. Fast and Furious 2, when they put the...
Jesus Christ, dude.
It's
we gotta get you watching better horror movies, man.
I realize how jarring that transition is to anybody who's not in my mind.
I'm open to it. What scared you?
When they put the bucket, the rats in the bucket,
oh,
and then on the
yeah.
guy's stomach, and they heat the
and
bucket,
so it eats through.
So the rats burrow inside. That for a Fast and Furious movie, that is as dark as it ever got.
It's crazy that what seems to scare you is physical trauma.
Physical trauma, like so. And I was a big fan of the Saw movies, right?
Because
I saw one. When
Saw
I was,
one isn't as torturing.
It's
as
not,
people remember.
It's really
it's
a psychological.
It's
more like
procedural.
Seven.
Yeah. It's a little closer to Seven. Yeah.
But that twist at the end, I respected so much that I forgot I was watching a scary movie.
Yeah.
But I also was checking the back seats of my van for the next, like, three weeks.
Yeah,
when
for
I
the
left
pig
the,
man.
When
yeah.
I left the movie theater at night by myself.
Do you remember who the red herring bad guy was in Saw?
Yeah, it was fucking Ben from
Ben
Lost.
Linus from Lost?
Yeah.
That's what I do, Jack.
That's a good
Ben.
That's
a good
Ben. I manipulate
people, Jack. That's what I do. I'm television Kevin Spacey.
But so then Saw 3, There was the Da Vinci guy.
Oh,
when
yeah.
When they twisted his arm.
Yeah.
When they twisted his limbs individually so far, they just fucking snapped.
Yeah.
That was fucked up.
There's a trap in the new Saw.
So I guess physical torture, yeah.
Yeah, like physical torture.
Anything but with like, the eyes. Or like in Halloween
that's
when I was...
scary? Like, is the word no, scary?
I guess it's like... I guess because I consider myself a pretty big empath, and so like when I see people on screen getting pain, I feel that pain, and that is what like in Halloween, the newest one, or not the newest one, the second newest one, when the dude like jumps from the hospital, or gets thrown from the hospital window, and you just see his fucking legs fold onto each other.
Oh yeah.
That fucked me up. Yeah. And I was like, and I was with my friend Kira, so I was like, what the fuck? How do you keep this on all the time?
She's like, it's fun.
Yeah, that's exactly what you fucking said.
Honestly, that is my answer. That is my answer. It's fun. That's funny, because, like, to me, I wouldn't define that as scary. I would define that as fucked up, shocking, upsetting. And, like, similarly, though, like, I will ruminate on those things. Like, I can freak myself out into paralysis thinking about specifically that casino scene.
Yeah.
Because that is
and
really
guess
scary.
And guess when it comes to find me? When I'm trying to fucking go to sleep at night.
Every time.
Yeah.
Every time. But, like... Yeah, I so maybe
so
I'm,
I think that, going, yeah, the, that residual, scary, yeah. The residual thoughts of that are what's scary to me.
Yeah,
I know that at some point this imagery is going to come back to me in a way that I don't feel comfortable with, especially when, you know, I'm having a good day.
Yeah.
Then it's like, oh, remember that time you watched a dude's legs fold beneath him because he got thrown by Michael Myers from a hospital window?
Oh, no. Now that I thought about it, it's going to happen to me.
Yeah, it's going to happen to me. I'm next. Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, I used to be afraid of Ernest Scared Stupid, the giant troll.
And you find the most creative ways to bring it back to Ernest.
But there's a line in Ernest Scared Stupid that horrified me because of this exact reason as to what we're talking about. In Ernest Scared Stupid, the kid reads about the killer trolls, and another character's like, oh, just because you read about it doesn't mean it's going to happen. And then it does happen to him. So when I'm at home and I'm like freaked out by that movie, I'm like, well, just because I watched it doesn't mean the trolls are going to come today. And then I'm like, but that's what happened to the kid in the movie, and I don't know Ernest. He can't help me with MEAC.
That's when you check your game genie to see what's going on. Now that's a deep cut. And if you know the answer to that riddle, comment and subscribe.
Subscribe at?
Hot Property.
No, that's not the one. We worked on this.
Okay, but in my defense, we haven't talked about The Shining at all.
Yes, we haven't talked about it. But now that we're talking about it, I wonder if it's even fair to call a movie scary in the moment. Because it seems that where we agree in scariness is that true scariness is after the movie ends.
Because, I know, but the idea of even putting a movie on...
it scares the shit out of
me. Scares me, because I know that there's going to be, there's going to be aftershocks of that film.
Do you think you'll have aftershocks from
The Shining? No, I've seen all the key scenes of this movie, way too much. And Ready Player One also really watered down the...
That was pretty cool, though.
I hated it.
Really?
Because of the book.
I like the book so much better.
I forget. What was the... I know I ask you this all the time. What was the challenge
that they replaced? I really don't remember.
Anyway.
Yeah, I don't remember at all.
So I do think that...
Would you say The Shining is a good movie? Do you like it?
Oh, yeah. And I'm getting into why. What I was really, really...
Doris is very interested in what you're saying.
I was really, really... I mean, obviously Kubrick's a master
at
his craft. And untouchable. You know, when you think about all the stuff that they went through in Room 237 and just how wildly different all of their theories were, from it's a reflection of how the, Native Americans were murdered at the hands of Eastern Europeans when we first landed here. And there could be about Kubrick's work on the fake moon landing and all this other stuff. And somehow... I'm excited to see how you bring these all together. But somehow, like, during the watch, I was only maybe 20% thinking about that stuff. And the rest of the time, just looking how fucking beautiful the movie is.
It's gorgeous.
It's absolutely just a masterclass cinematography and color theory and all this stuff. And you can tell just by how they film it when all the turns are.
Yeah.
And that's what I like a lot. Because just by with the color grading and the set grading, And what's funny is that I had a thought, and this is like such a millennial who's never seen The Shining before thought, but I compared the set design to Barbie.
Yeah, no, honestly,
because it was like, it's that, because like when you think about Barbie, it was like, it had to be very precise. It had to be very much like every detail had to be down to the pinkest it could be.
Yeah, yeah.
And this one had to be down to the bloodiest it could be. And like both very similar attacks to like set design, and both successful.
I think that some of the things that you see in something like The Shining is something that outside of Barbie, you don't actually see in a lot of movies, because there's a lot of intentionality going into the pre-production of how it's going to look, yeah, because you're actually using real sets. In Room 237, they talk about the illogical architecture of the Overlook Hotel and how Kubrick purposefully made sure that none of it actually integrates or makes sense. If you're not paying attention, even if you are paying attention, it's hard to notice because it's such a vast labyrinthine thing. But if you're really looking, you notice that it is illogical and none of it lines up. And so my guess would be that he's doing that to kind of subconsciously make you feel uncomfortable. A movie that's shot on green screens and a movie that's shot, just in a green box in Georgia with digital backgrounds that you can tell are digital, you know, and a lot of times you can't tell and it looks like a set. You wouldn't be able to pull that trick simply because of the falsity of it. But because this is brick, mortar, wood, all of this stuff, and it's actually in frame, I think it gives it an opportunity to unsettle like that. Barbie, similarly, is done almost entirely practically as well.
Yeah.
The entirety of Barbie's world is done on practical sets, and it's remarkable. And that captures that you're looking at it like a toy, like a play set. And if it was all digital, that would not exist.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get that feeling that you're looking at a play set, and the film would be weaker for it. And that's why kudos to Greta Gerwig for doing it sort of old style like that. So yeah, I think you're right. One of the things about The Shining, maybe it's just because it's old that it's like that, but the fact that you have, and I just looked it up, John Alcott is your cinematographer, the fact that you have people working with film, building a set to match the color design, to match Kubrick's crazy imagination of how it's got to look and how it's got to feel, you know, for Jack to walk into the Colorado room and have it filled with people, that feels tactile and tangible because it's filled with people. It wouldn't be like that now. We would have a couple people in the front and then a blue screen background that just has digital people there. And it might look perfect, but that feel wouldn't be there. And The Shining is like a masterful management of using the set and the way the camera moves within that set to give that feel.
And no depth of field.
And that just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
It exists in Barbie.
Rarely, so the idea of kind of, who's that abstract artist with the stairs?
Escher. Yeah.
Yeah, so the idea of kind of like an Escher-esque hotel, I didn't understand that until it was explained to me in the documentary. But I remember that, because before they say anything, they showed that scene in the beginning where Jack walks into the manager's office and there's that window there.
Yeah.
And when I saw that the first time without it being explained, I was like, this is fucking weird, like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand why.
It wasn't until Room 237. Until
they explained to me, like, that window shouldn't be there. If you look at the length of the hallway that Jack turns off of into the office, it's all just building.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns to the office and somehow there's this window, the stray window looking to the outside that shouldn't be there. And when they revealed that to me in the documentary, I was like, that's why I felt so uncomfortable when he walked in this room.
Yeah.
And that's like, and it's like Kubrick's doing this thing that like Picasso would do. Like Picasso was like a phenomenal painter in real life, but he's famous for the way he was able to manipulate space and do.
Well, he went from being a realist painter to being abstract.
And that's what Kubrick's doing here. It's like his abstractions
wouldn't work without the training of realism. Like, you can't draw a cartoon. Like, you can't draw a cartoon cat until you can probably draw a real good real cat.
Because you and I have seen enough movies where we know a mistake when we see it.
Yeah.
And I think the general audience subconsciously is also capable of doing this. Like, you know a mistake when you see it because it's inherently wrong.
It's just untrue,
But when you see somebody make a mistake on purpose, I think people also subconsciously understand, like, that's not a mistake. That was done on purpose.
Yeah, and something's up.
Something is.
And you might not go, like, what is that? But your gut is just like,
the inherent feeling of uncomfortability is.
The thing that they point
something
out.
Something that Kubrick does so well. That's his brush stroke, yeah. Because all these lingering shots, like, they. I know. And, like, as, like, all the lingering shots are happening, I was like, I know what you're doing, Kubrick. Come on, Stanley. Yeah. We've seen this one before.
Listen, Kubes. The one that they point out in Room 237 that always stuck with me, because it's the one that subconsciously unsettled me most, because it was the most shocking to me when they pointed out, was the TVs not being plugged in.
I couldn't stop staring at that.
None of the TVs are plugged in, and it seems so weird. And
I was trying to figure out how they did it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, honestly. But that's also one of those things that could potentially lose effect over time, because growing up as a kid, we had block TVs, mm-hmm. and I could see the plugs because our TV was sitting on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, that's just what it was. And, you know, it wasn't until nowadays that the TVs are flat and you don't, you know, everything's built into the wall and all that we don't even see the plugs. So now I don't think it would register with a younger audience to even be subconsciously affected by the fact that the TV's not plugged in. It's like, that's an element that might lose effectiveness with time. And we're like kind of the last generation, I think, to get a gut reaction to specifically that thing. But I think that's, you're looking at me and Doris is staring at me right over your shoulder. And your eyes were lined up just staring. She's like, yes, the plugs on the TV. Nothing to chew.
What do you think Kubrick would make a movie about if he was still alive today?
Well, his last movie that he worked on but didn't actually get to complete, but he wrote the script for, was AI, Artificial Intelligence.
Oh, and that was him?
That was him and Spielberg worked on that together. And then he died. And it's great. And you're going to cry.
I'll be honest with you. Haley Joel Osment deterred me from
it. Really? Oh, well, he's great in it. But
after
there's
Sixth Sense, I was like, I can't take that. I like him as an adult.
Yeah. Now that he's just a schlubby guy.
As in Zully's fucking hilarious. But as a kid, I just couldn't stand the asshole.
He memed a little bit. Yeah. A little bit before we did memes. But like, there's a very Kubrickian choice in there that I wonder if that was something that he fed to Spielberg before they made it. But Haley Joel Osment never blinks in that movie. He plays a robot. Yeah. And so at no point does he blink. Whether they shot around it or digitally removed blinks, I don't know. But that feels like a choice, you know, like in this movie, of the illogical architecture and things like that. But to answer your question, I think that's what we would see Kubrick doing. Because with 2001, he was exploring, you know, what does the future look like for technology? You've seen 2001, right?
Yeah.
And so HAL, the robot, is, you know, goes sentient and in an act of self-preservation becomes murderous. And it's not malevolent, it's just
survival.
Self-defense. It's just survival, And so with that, and then something like AI.
Can't wait to live that one out, by the way.
Yeah. And then something like AI, which is about, you know, at what point do these robot servants actually become, you know, at what point is this life?
Yeah.
I think we would have seen him going further down that path and exploring, you know, asking the question like, you know, how many wires do we have to connect before this thing's self-determination stops resembling programming and starts resembling a personality?
I would say similar. Like my thought was something along the lines of like how we're constantly glued to these screens and things like that. I looked at my phone. But something like along the lines of that, I think he would definitely like to play with. But overall, I think that... Oh, and you know my favorite... This is, I'm just going to jump around now.
Jump around. No, we got plenty of time. I've got more prompts to go through.
My first note was... And when she's talking to the doctor, she's smoking a cigarette.
Mm.
And this is probably something that was intentional because it made me wildly uncomfortable the entire time. But her ass just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it doesn't fall, and she never ashes it. And the entire... I can't concentrate on what she's saying because all I'm thinking is, can you please ash that cigarette? And I gotta say, that's an intentional choice.
I think that's an intentional choice because... So, like, I saw the new Scorsese movie last night. It's fantastic. But one thing about Scorsese is oftentimes you'll see in his edits something will change hands. And, you know, it's not that it's a sloppy edit, but it's just he doesn't necessarily give a shit about the continuity. if this take has the best performance and this take has the best performance and the cup in your hand switches hands, I don't care.
Yeah.
Because we're not here for that. That doesn't matter. And, you know, he subverts it in Shutter Island, where there's a couple scenes where he does that purposefully because of the, you know, sort of blending of reality and imagination there. But, like, you know, and, like, his editor, Schoonmaker, is the best in the business. And so this is not a mistake by any means. It's just they're capturing the best performance. I don't think Kubrick would allow for that. He would say, let's shoot this again, give me the great performance, but put the cup in the other hand.
Yeah.
And so I think that you're right that the cigarette ash, because I noticed that too, is orchestrated to make you feel the way that you did, where you're like, fucking go! You
know, there was one time, there was a moment where I thought that it wasn't even like a fake, it was like an actual solid prop.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was like, there's no way that she's keeping her hand that still. And that brings up another thought. That's probably the last time we see her hand that still.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And so there is a famous story about the scene with the baseball bat up the steps. Apparently they did over 100 takes on that. Now, there is a myth that in later years, Shelley Duvall has had some mental health issues. And there's a myth that persists despite being completely disproven that Kubrick abused her on the set in order to get a response. According to her directly, he's a sweetheart. He's just a perfectionist. And there's nothing like that. But the scene going up the steps, they did that hundreds of times. And it wasn't because they didn't nail it. It wasn't because, you know, he was being a sick, you know, a tyrant or anything. It was simply because he needed them to be so fucking exhausted that they're manic. And no matter how manic Nicholson, who's the best at being manic, is, and
that's Duvall, that's his default. Like,
honestly, one of my favorite performances of all time is from Shelley Duvall. There's a manic level that I think comes from the exhaustion of doing it that speaks to you've been in here for 3 months or however long it is, and you know, so that myth of him torturing them is exactly that, a myth. Mm-hmm. But it is from the truth of, like, that's how specific he was. That's how specific his style was like, your manic was great, but we're going to do this 100 more times until your manic is where it's got to be, you know? And no actor is going to be able to act that manic, but if you're exhausted, we'll get there, you know? And, like, that's the game that he played. So, like, I would be willing to bet that he probably shot that cigarette 50 different times and was like, the ash fell, light a new one, start over, action, the ash fell, you know, boom, boom, boom. And,
that's crazy.
You know, and so I think that probably is, I mean, that's definitely a choice, but that's probably what happened. Or she nailed it the first time and it just didn't fall. Maybe. And
she was very good the entire time.
Oh my God.
Even that kid.
So good.
Yeah.
I think he's like a lawyer now. I don't think he did any other movies.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, I think...
answered it before I could.
I think his... Let's see what his... if he has any other... Danny Lloyd. Yeah, he's got really no credits. He's in The Shining. He's in a G. Gordon Liddy movie called Young... where he plays Young Liddy. And... and apparently he cameos in Dr. Sleep as spectator.
I said I didn't want to know anything.
I mean, I didn't know it, and I've seen that movie like 4 times, so I think you're good.
When he goes into, or when they're getting the tour, and the guy starts listing all the food, and I made a comment about how he's George R.R. Martin.
Yeah.
I've been in scenarios like that, and that is a real life nightmare, where someone's just talking at me way too much. So that was the scariest part of the movie.
I'm sorry.
For me.
Not I feel you. Like I'm that guy.
No, not you.
I've it's been like, that guy.
No, definitely not you.
It's funny that you bring
up... You know who was that guy? Mark from Chili's.
Oh, yeah. Mark. Shout out, Mark. Funny that you bring up George R.R. Martin, because he's buddies with Stephen King. And George R.R. Martin has done many events with Stephen King where they like... Do they really?
No, I mean... They live in Maine, so like there's like 8 people there. Where so writers technically, they do live next door to each other.
He always says to Stephen... Because Stephen King pumps out books like I pump out shits. He just goes and goes and goes. And George R.R. Martin pumps out books like I... And
George R.R. Martin has been constipated.
Yeah, he's been constipated. He's never going to release the next book. It's done.
I think he thought he'd be dead by now.
Well, I have a theory. I think that he was so turned off by the response to later stage Game of Thrones that he finished the book and it will be released upon his death, so that he doesn't have to worry about feedback.
Oh yeah,
and honestly,
I heard he is a chronic comment reader.
Yeah,
and that does affect him.
I'm sure it does. And
well, don't get famous then.
But yeah, I'm into that plan. I think it's good. But he always said to Stephen King, like, you know, how do you pump out all of these books? And Stephen King was just like, yeah, you know, this is what I do.
I lock myself in a motel. I used to be a cokehead. 5 months.
Yeah, and now I'm not a cokehead, so I need something to do.
Yeah.
But then George R. R. Martin with the food, and I've probably related this on the podcast before. George R. R. Martin was asked in an interview, someone said, why do you spend so much time describing things like food? And he said, why are you reading fiction just to finish it? You're supposed to enjoy it. He was like, and you can enjoy what I'm writing about food, or you can blast through it to get to the end. But like, I'm here to put you in that world, and describing the food is part of that. And it's funny because in doing that, he sort of answers his own question to Stephen King, where it's like, you know, Stephen King, how do you get those books? And he's like, I just go, man. And it's like, how come you don't finish books, George R. R. Martin? He's like, because I got to write up about my ribs. You know, I got to get the, like, oh, this mutton sounds juicy, and I'm going to devote 8 pages to it.
I think, like, book three, there was, like, two and a half pages worth of food descriptors. And the only reason I read through it, it reminded me of, like, a Bret Easton Ellis, like, when in American Psycho.
Oh, the run-on sentences when there's just 5 pages, yeah.
In, like, the first 10 pages of American Psycho, it's just 4 full pages of block text describing all the shit.
And Steve is moving his hands up and down to indicate that there's no indentations at all.
Zero indentation. And it's just describing every item in Patrick's apartment. And I always thought it'd be funny if they hit a little message in there, like, at the end of this book, Patrick Bateman dies.
Yeah. There's...
And then he had an RCH stereo.
There's a passage in the middle of American Psycho that's great, where it's, I think it's like a 5 or 6 page run-on sentence. The sentence doesn't break, but it's a chase scene, and it isn't until you get to the end that your brain stops when it hits that period and you realize you were reading a run-on, but you feel the action of the chase because it never stopped. It's like a brilliantly done piece of prose.
What you just said reminded me of something that's going to take us to a left.
Please.
But what was with the dude at the end with the split head? They touched on this a little bit in the documentary, but the guy with the split head who's like, it's a wonderful party, isn't it? And then like...
That's Grady.
That was Grady?
That was Delbert Grady, and that's his shotgun wound because he blew his own head off with the shotgun.
And my big question is, so you said that the unlocking of the door was the only supernatural thing to happen.
The only physical interaction between something like the only actual physical effect that they had on a real tangible item in the hotel, because everything else is visions. As Scatman Crothers says, they're like pages, they're pictures in a book. They're not actually there. It's just they're imprintations of these things that, because the hotel shines just like Danny shines and just like he shines. So the only time that something physical is affected by one of these imprints is that.
How is she able to see stuff at the end?
I think she shines a little too, and just her shine has turned down a little bit with life.
That was really confusing for me.
I mean, I think it's a mix of she shines a little bit and the hotel shines a lot.
Yeah.
Because, I mean...
I guess.
You know, but the thing is with... Okay, so... We'll get it. Let's talk about...
There's no King's, fucking answer, though, is
King's
there?
Distaste for the movie is because... So I've read the book, The Shining, and it's very different.
Why don't you brag about it?
And I will. And I read it, and I actually read... I have the first edition copy. It's great.
Oh, great.
But The Shining, and I can see why Stephen King didn't like the movie. And the reason he gave, and it's not invalid, is that... To him, he felt that at the beginning of the film, The Shining, Jack was already crazy. Whereas the book is a slow descent of Jack.
Yeah.
Relapsing into alcoholism as put forth by this hotel waking up because of the presence of Danny.
I'm going to agree with King's assessment on that, because I did have a feeling in the middle of it where I was like, oh, shit. So it's just like, it's going to go? We're just doing it?
But let's boil that down a little bit. So we boil it down from, okay, you know, sure, I agree that like... That his Jack starts out in a way where he's like a little bit, he seems unhinged already. But
because even in the car on the way there,
he's perturbed.
He's already got eyebrows for days.
Yeah.
He's like, "It's all right. We can talk about cannibalism." Yeah. Like, all right. Fuck. You haven't even got to the hotel yet, dude.
You know, people taste like pork chops, Danny. You know. So I agree with that. But I think if we boil that down, it's that King took issue with the fact that so much of the plot information was removed.
Yeah.
In exchange for more tonal feeling stuff.
And isn't the hedge maze not even in the book?
Hedge maze, instead, it's topiary animals made out of bushes that at some point do become alive.
Oh, that's cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
And it's very well done. And the book is great. But as an adaptation...
If I start now, I could read it before I die.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I would actually recommend reading it. And it reads pretty quick. It's not a very long book. So I think King was more upset, I'm assuming, that plot elements were taken away. But I think that their intentions were very different, because King's intentions, as with a lot of his novels, is he's working out the fact that he is an addict. He was a cocaine addict, he was an alcoholic, he had addiction problems, and he had them at a time when he had young kids and a new wife and all that. And so I think The Shining is him sort of exercising a little bit of that. Mm. Whereas I don't think Kubrick is telling a story about addiction. Yes, there's addiction stuff in it. I think his story is, you know, it's less concerned with the plot of the hotel, because he didn't need to tease out the idea of this guy who's trying to stay clean slowly getting unclean.
Yeah.
I think instead he was trying to tell a story of... And I guess we can get into what I think this movie's about. A story of a guy who has made a commitment that he can't fulfill, but he can't back out of. And I think that this movie is filled with items of I'm stuck to this. And for every character. You know, Jack is stuck in a marriage that he is pretty unhappy with. He's stuck being a father to a kid that he loves, but just has no time for. He's got a contract for a book that he's trying to fulfill. He's got a contract to watch this hotel that he's trying to do. But then also we have Wendy. Wendy is also stuck in this marriage that she cannot get out of no matter what. She is already doing damage to herself as a chain smoker. But at this point, why go backwards? Just keep on smoking. Like, there's all these little things like that I think tie into it. Choosing sobriety is, I already fucked up. I already accidentally hurt my kid, so I have to stay sober. Was I an alcoholic? I don't know. But I can't go down that path now. I'm stuck to this commitment of sobriety because of some fucked up thing I can't take away. And I think that this whole movie is about what happens after you do the thing that you can't take away. How do you behave there? And so to take us to room 237, when he's talking about the kid backing up over the footsteps, that I think that ties into this.
And he's whereas, breaking the mold.
Yeah, and so like if we go through all of the, you know, okay, so, you know, there's the Holocaust, the Native American genocide in America, there's the moon landing, there is...
And the Game of Thrones.
Well, there's
I thought we were naming trends.
No, the Minotaur in the labyrinth, all these things. What do
I'm
all
so
this,
sorry, well, okay. Everyone.
What do all these things have in common, though, is like, if you're stuck, like, even the guy says, you know, about the hedge maze, don't go in unless you have an hour to spend. Don't make the decision you can't take back unless you can deal with that decision. And so I think all of that is in there. It's like, there was a point where it was like, we are going to mow over the indigenous people because we've come too far. We can't go back on that. And so we're just going to be fucking monsters. You know, the Holocaust, once that Pandora's box was opened, there was no going back on that. So you just got to go through and fucking... genocide people is, you know, the moon landing. Kennedy said we are going to the moon, and then we were stuck even after he died going to the moon based on that decision to the point where now that we said it, we're in a race with Russia to the point where someone might decide we have to fake it just to win the PR battle against Russia. You know, the Minotaur is in the labyrinth. What happens in the labyrinth? You go into the maze and you can't get out. Now you have to finish the maze in order to get out. You know, all of these things are, you know, we look at American history, there are, like, we cannot undo the genocide of indigenous people. It can't be undone. The bell is rung.
Yeah.
And so I think all of those things tie together with this theme of, that's what the Kubrick Shining, not King's Shining, Kubrick Shining, to me, is about precisely that. is I did the terrible thing. I am through. I'm past the Rubicon here. How do I behave, and how do I become, you know, how do I justify being, you know, an adult human man who has this skeleton in my closet that cannot be purged? And I think that's what the movie in Kubrick's eyes is about. And I think ultimately what won King over, if I were to bet, would be that idea.
Mm.
Because, again, that is also addiction, is like, you know, you don't get addicted to heroin by not doing it, but once you're addicted, you go, fuck, I should never have stuck that needle in my arm.
Yeah.
Too fucking late. You did the thing. And so now you have to, you know, and to me, that's what Shining is about in Kubrick's thing.
I can definitely see that, and I think
that's what ties all of those weird harebrained things together, is they are all based in this idea of you cannot go backwards. You're going to have to go forwards.
Hey everybody, it's me, Dan, just throwing in a quick ad here to remind you to follow us at Movie MovieCast on all of the things, and also to check out scullyvision.com for all the things that I do and all things related to the Hot Property Podcast Network. You can check out our other show, Hot Property, at Hot Property Pod on all of the things. And if you have a moment, it really helps out a lot if you leave us a review, or if you give us a like, share it with your friends, tell somebody, tell anybody about how much fun you have listening to us. Thank you so much for listening. Happy Halloween. We love you guys. This episode was so much fun to record, and we hope to keep giving you more. So thank you again, and at MovieMovieCast on all of the things. Be nice to each other. Be kind. All right? Don't be bitches.
What I like about the movie, and kind of what I took from it, and I'm still digesting, to be honest with you, but this is one of the benefits of seeing Room 237 before watching this, is that I kind of had this idea of, you know, I like this movie a lot because everybody gets something different from it.
Mm.
And it's really fun to think about too, especially when you have that juxtaposition with the big theme of mirrors in the movie, where, you know, was this film almost intentionally done to be as ambiguous as it is so that everybody can take a different take from it?
I think 100% that's intentional on Kubrick's part.
And that's genius.
Yeah.
That's 1,000 IQ movie making.
Mm.
And for me, that's what I love the most about the film, other than its phenomenal color palette.
Yeah, it really does have such a good color palette. It's so good. I love the cozy feeling inside the hotel when there's snow outside. I love the way that, like, you know, we can go from you know, a beige room to, like, that the bathroom is stark reds. You know, so phenomenal, yeah.
The next point I have about that's going to tie in the color to our, you know, what's a mistake and what's not.
Mm.
In the bathroom, you have Torrance talking to Grady, and Grady is kind of framed between these two rectangular pillars of light.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Which opposes Lloyd, the bartender.
Yeah.
He's always, the light is directly behind his head, and then the booze on the outside, the way that he's framed. I didn't notice that. 100% of the time, yeah.
But what I did notice is that later on, in the famous Here's Johnny scene, you only see him take out one part of that doorway.
Mm.
And then when he turns around because he hears the cook coming, you see that now that left rectangle is also missing, framing him up exactly like Grady was framed up.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Nice.
I noticed that.
That's got to be on purpose. That's got to be on purpose.
Because now
that's wild.
Because in
let's watch it again.
Let's do it. In the bathroom scene, when Grady says that line that I asked about while we were watching, it was where he was like, you've always been the caretaker.
Yeah.
Like, that to me, that visual cue says he's always been the fucking caretaker.
Yeah.
And I thought that was cool as hell when I realized that.
That ties into, I think, what I'm saying too about, you know, the permanence of the untakebackable decision. Yeah. And like when they say you've always been the caretaker,
the caretaker is inside of all of us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you, like, it's almost like, years ago, you set yourself down this path, you set yourself down this path when you dislocated Danny's shoulder and decided to go sober. There's no stopping it. Now, personally, like, do I believe that there is stopping it? Of course. In the case of the movie, no. But, like, you know, and I think that also ties in, like, with the hotel itself. This hotel is stuck in 1921.
Yeah.
July 4th, 1921. That is the, and now, I don't know if a disaster happened there that night and everyone's trapped there, or if it's just, that was the night that we had a man in a dog suit having, you know, blowing a guy.
Okay, yeah, what the fuck?
That's just one of the many sins that happened, and I say sins in a, you know,
yeah, let's not kink shame here.
I don't mean to do that.
Because I have, like, a really good setup for when I go home after this podcast.
Fair enough.
It's eerily similar to what we're describing.
Right on. The no, but I mean, like, in terms of, like,
I'm the dog.
You know, the hotel sees, I don't want to say, like, filth, but, like,
secrets.
Exactly. Yeah, secrets hidden in there. And it's, like,
secrets can be innocuous or they can be epic.
They can be epic. Yeah. And it could be, like, you know, that dog suit could be someone with a spouse and with kids that just found themselves into this secret, you know, sexy thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know the story of the lady in the tub that died and maybe was forgotten about there and rotted away in the tub, you know, overdosed or whatever, or is just some sort of a ghost thing. I'm assuming, the thing is, though, we can assume that the twins are Grady's kids, except for the fact that they refer to Grady's kids at being a different age. And they're twins, so they'd be the same age. Because he says, yeah. Oh, Grady killed his kids. One was like 5, one was 9 or something.
Also, those twins look nothing alike.
They look exactly alike.
They look nothing. If you take...
They're identical twins in real life.
If you look at just... they're wearing the same thing.
Yeah.
But if you look at just the neck up, they look fucking nothing alike.
I disagree with that. I think they look exactly alike the way that twins look exactly alike. at this picture.
I'll look at it. This is a great visual bit for an audio medium.
It's so funny because all these pictures are like people in cosplays, and so they don't look alike. But no, they are identical twin sisters.
Well,
yeah, they look very much alike.
No.
Yes.
No way. Look at their eyes are totally different.
Their eyes are exactly the same.
The nose on the left, is thinner than the one on the right.
Well, they are identical twins. I don't know how else to say it. But still, either way, the point being, whether they look identical or not, the point being, they are meant to be twins.
Yeah.
And Grady's children are not twins, because they mention that they're years apart rather than minutes apart. So I think that the suggestion is that, like, this might be a cyclical thing that has happened. And sure, Ullman at the beginning tells Jack, like, yeah, 30 years ago, the caretaker, you know, killed his kids, his wife, shot himself in the head and all that. But, like, the guy before Ullman might have another story from 30 years before he retired, or, you know, whatever it is.
So it's like the Santa Claus, where you inherit the caretaker.
You grow the beard.
By killing your family.
But, like, so the idea of, you know, you've always been the caretaker comes from, like, this hotel is stuck. Like, there was some original sin, to use another stupid term. There was some original sin that may have happened in this hotel that stuck.
Well, yeah, it was the fucking building it over an Indian burial ground.
Yes, yeah.
Native American Indian. They said Indian the entire movie. Yeah,
so that cannot be undone.
Native American burial.
And now that decision is made, there is, you know, call it a curse, call it whatever it is. There is now, like, we can't move forward because we're defined by that mistake.
Yeah.
And so, again, I think that ties into what I think the movie's about, which is, you know, once you're in, you can't go back, so you've got to...
And I do like the fact that in the doc, they were talking about how the elevator is the blood of the Native Americans that it was built on, because the elevator always goes deeper than the foundation.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot, and I think that Kubrick probably definitely had that in mind.
Oh, yeah. Even if he's not talking specifically about Native American... Just the idea that, like, the elevator's going to go lower. The elevator's going to find what's in the foundation of this building. Because that's... So, in the book, they mention you have to reset the boiler every...
I was going to ask about that.
So, in the book, that's the ticking time bomb, is that you do have to release the steam on the boiler once in a while.
That would have been a really
and
cool...
And so, that's a ticking time bomb throughout the book. And so, in the book... Because of this boiler and because of everything that's going, because of Danny's presence sort of unlocking the way it shines, the hotel is sort of in a state of potential self-destruction at all times. And
it's trying to save people from itself.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. Or even just trying to absorb the people into itself, which I guess sort of happens with Jack at the end. But like the boiler is meant as this ticking time bomb that plot-wise is just, you've got to get away from Jack, and we also got to get to the basement and get this boiler before it blows. But again, that also ties into a little bit, you know, that could have been used, I think, in the movie, into that theme of just like, you do have to address that thing that's boiling under the surface, because if you don't, it will blow. You know, you do have to figure out, you know, like you do have to address the fact that this is on a burial ground.
I'm surprised they didn't keep that in, because that's a really, that's ripe for a visual narrative element.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
But again, that feels plot heavy. And this is a movie that's not particularly plot heavy.
Do you think that eventually someone will make a Shining that's closer to the book version?
They did. Mick Garris did. It's a multi-part television.
Okay, but like an event. Actual. I'm talking about like a fucking real.
It's not
blockbuster
great.
Release.
Maybe at some
not
point.
Like horror movies are usually.
King wrote the screenplay for the TV movie. Okay. It's like a 5-hour movie because it's one of those like multi-part events. It does star Stephen Weber, aka Brian Hackett from Wings, as Jack Torrance.
I don't know who that is.
He plays Brian Hackett in Wings.
This is fucking.
No, for real, that is who's in it.
This is but that Three's Company thing.
They do have the topiaries in it. The hedge maze is not in it. They do have the boiler, and in the book, it is not an axe. It is a cricket bat.
Who plays Shelley Duvall?
I actually don't remember. Television. It's been years since I've seen it. I actually have it on DVD somewhere, buried upstairs. Mm. But I would like to watch it again, having read the book.
But do you think like. You know, there'll be like a major studio one film release, or is this a book that you can't really tie down?
No, I think you could.
Okay.
I think it could happen again, but I think the shadow of Kubrick's The Shining it looms large. It is, everybody loves it.
It might not be in our lifetime.
I don't think it would be in our lifetime. But I mean, like, you know, we'll die long before Star Wars ever dies. And in that sense, I think that The Shining being such an all-time... But I will say this, had Kubrick not made The Shining, would that book have ever become... Would this potentially become a movie ever? No, I don't think that the longevity of The Shining is because of King so much as it's because of Kubrick's movie.
Interesting.
It's an awesome book. It's like a really great book. But yeah, I think that the longevity of it is owed to the iconography of the movie.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me, because that's great iconography for
sure. It's the best. But I do think that, like, because, you know, like, everybody recognizes the fucking carpet. You see that pattern. Yeah. That's the Shining carpet. Even if you haven't seen The Shining, you know that's the Shining carpet. I think there will one day be that. But see, I don't want to say anything about Dr. Sleep.
Don't!
Because the angle that they go, because with Dr. Sleep... This is not a spoiler. I promise you this is more...
I wish we had that recorded on video, because that was a funny exchange.
An aperitif for what's coming. Dr. Sleep was a book that was a sequel to the book The Shining, not to the movie.
Okay, start over. Dr. Sleep was a book was a sequel to the book
The Shining. It has nothing to do with the movie.
The movie Dr. Sleep is not a direct sequel to the movie The Shining.
Yes, it is. And that's what's so interesting about it.
What the fuck? That
Stephen King wrote Dr. Sleep as a sequel to his own book and did not consider the movie The Shining when writing it. It's just book one, book two. In adapting the book to the big screen, Mike Flanagan, who did the job, had to successfully adapt the book itself and also make sure it functions as a sequel to the movie. Because of that iconography.
So it's like that Japanese
knocks
hinge.
Knocks it out of the park.
You know what I mean?
Maybe.
Where the Japanese hinge has to come together in a certain...
Oh, yeah.
To make a perfect 90-degree angle.
And honestly, nails it.
Nice.
To the point that Stephen King likes the movie Dr. Sleep, but like it is The Shining 2 in all ways.
So
but
do
it's
you
also
have to see
direct...
this movie to enjoy Dr. Sleep?
To enjoy it, no.
Or to understand
fully
what's going
understand.
On.
I, Honestly, I think you could probably get away just knowing the iconography of The Shining. Okay. But I would say that you would be robbing yourself of... Because it is technically The Shining 2. It's not a reboot. It is listed... When you go on IMDb, The Shining is followed by Dr. Sleep. It is the sequel to The Shining. And it's based on the sequel book that's a sequel to the original book that is not as similar to The Shining. It's brilliant. I don't know how they did
Where does that movie with John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson fit?
1408?
1408.
Well, Ka is a wheel, my friend. Sorry, I'm going to quote The Dark Tower now. All of Stephen King's work ties together under the realm of The Dark Tower. But I don't want to explode your head. Well, The Dark Tower is like...
Buckle in, audience. We're going for... No, I'm just kidding.
Dark Tower is like an omnibus of all of Stephen King's influences, and it ties into certain things. Like, there's characters from...
Why was it the worst movie? Into it.
The movie has almost no resemblance to the books. There's like 7 books, and it is a sweeping... It's remarkable. And it actually addresses the big criticism of Stephen King is that he can't stick landings. I don't always agree. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. And he makes a very strong and actually rather George R. Martinian case for you're not here for the ending, you're here for the journey. And the whole Dark Tower is really about that. But like things tie into the Dark Tower that connect pretty much all of his work.
Mm.
And so 1408 I don't think has any direct connections, but you know, it's like the St. Elsewhere Globe. It's just, it's not connected.
Okay.
That said, 1408, but okay, wait, let's do it. Because 1408 is about a haunted hotel room that is, as we see in both the movie and the short story it's based on, there are hauntings in there and imprintations in it that are only in the eye of the beholder. Nothing physical happens to John Cusack that he doesn't do to himself in 1408. It's all in a reaction to what he sees or is made to see by the things in the room. And in that sense, the function of what's happening there is potentially that room shines and is shining upon him.
Or is he shining?
Maybe a little bit of both.
Interesting.
But like, you know, it could be argued that like the same malady affects room 1408 as does affect room 237 or as in the book 217.
That's a lot of numbers.
Yeah, he changed it to 237 for the Kubrick movie. I don't know why. To ask that one guy, he's 42. Two times three is six, times seven is 42. Numerology is always so stupid.
My last 2 points before we, if you want to move on to whatever you have, in the final maze scene, I noticed the audio, by the way, is great the entire time.
Yeah,
and the audio engineers need a pat on the back. But there's this... there's this constant like freezing sound going on during the maze race. Yeah, that I really, really enjoyed, and I thought that was a really good addition. And then my other thing was it's funny to me today. So this movie makes sense that they're cut off. Communication is easy to cut off in the 70s.
Yeah, right?
Or the 80s. It's funny to me today to watch movies try to isolate people. Now that we have such technology where I can communicate on my watch or my phone or my iPad or my computer.
I'm connected.
Or I can just, you know, whatever. But, man, how easy was it back in the 80s to be like, the phones are down. Well.
The end. He took the little chunky.
Yeah, he took the chunky battery out of the radio. Yeah.
Well, now that's why every horror movie now is about, I'm too connected. I need to get away from the connection. Like, that we've switched.
I'm going into the woods and turning everything off.
Yeah. Like, it's got to be. Well, but, like, the horror itself might even be the connectivity as opposed to the horror. Yeah. But, you know, like,
what was that one movie? That way.
I'm going to need more than that.
It was the movie where, like, cell phones just came out. And then they had a
Pulse?
Pulse.
Pulse is a remake of a Japanese movie called Cairo, and Cairo is one of the scariest movies I have ever seen.
But America Americanized it.
Americanized it. It's a decent adaptation, actually. Yeah.
And it worked.
It was a decent adaptation. Yeah. I'm into it. Yeah, I...
Who was famous in that movie? There was like one... They had one famous person, and then they died, I think.
Pulse... oops, I went on to the Japanese one. Kristen Bell was the star of Pulse.
Yeah.
And Ian Somerhalder.
America's favorite.
Octavia Spencer's in it. Man, I haven't seen that since the theater. Ricky Lindholm from Garfunkel and Oates. Wow. Oh, I might have to watch this again. Brad Dourif's in it. He plays thin, bookish guy. Surprising no one.
I would cast him as a thin, bookish
guy. Yeah, that's his bread and butter. But I have a friend who writes mystery novels. Shout out Dave Taruso. And he said that is one of the hardest things about writing a mystery novel is you've got to write around, like, just call him.
Yeah.
Shoot him a text. Like, so much problem is just solved. Like, well, did he have his GPS on? Yeah. Like, all of that does it. And there's the running joke that most of Seinfeld wouldn't exist if they had cell phones.
Or Friends.
Because yeah. It would just be like... Just
or any him. Sitcom in the 90s.
Yeah, just call him. Not Wings. Wings doesn't do that.
Oh, God.
Wings is more about planes, if you believe it or not.
What?
And Roy Biggins. Roy Biggins. And, of course, Antonio Scarpacci. I thought Scarpacci. Wings
was the story of... The South Philadelphia tradition of Wingfest every year.
Dude, now that would be a show I would watch.
I would not.
So, no, Wings is about taxi cabs, and Taxi, believe it or not, is about
the Air Force.
So, the only other note that I have here, I have two more notes. One is there anything in the movie that you would change? Because I have, even though I think the movie is perfect, there's one thing I think I would change.
Yes, I would make everything a lot more clear.
See, I would not.
I would take the audience's hand and guide them through a narrative that made sense. No, I don't know. It's hard because, again, I'm still digesting it as a full movie to me because I've seen it in piecemeal before this.
Well, I'll tell you what I'd change when you think about it. Because,
you know, actually, I will say this. The all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Yeah.
So I
that's in the book.
I know, but I'd only seen that. Which is like, oh, she finds one page in a typewriter. It's so much. And to borrow a quote from Jack Nicholson. To borrow a quote from him, it was pretty fucking sinister. To see that he wrote an entire novel of just that.
Because you're like, he's been losing it for longer than we even knew. Yeah.
Exactly. And that was a very so even then, even though I knew pretty much everything that I thought I knew, that everything this movie had to offer, I still was surprised by that. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Like, that was a good oh, shit moment.
And I think that's sold a lot by Wendy.
Yeah, she's great. Because
she has, like, a moment of, like, I thought I could handle Shelley this. Shelley Duvall? But again, Shelley Duvall, she's like, I thought I, you know, made the right decision marrying this guy. I thought I could manage
his
overbearingness, and I thought I could manage his temperamentalness. Yeah. But then when you see that, she's like, he's on a completely different page.
Yeah.
Like, there's just nothing
literally.
There. Yeah, literally. The one thing I would change, and even though it's iconic, and even though I do love it, and I think it works in the movie, I could do it without Red Rum. Because as soon as Red Rum shows up, you go, well, that's murder backwards. And so when they do the reveal of Red Rum, and it's a dad, she's like, you're like, we knew that.
I know, but I was thinking...
But they also don't milk it. It kind of appears, reveals, and then it goes. It kind of happens in, like, right in the middle of the movie. Like, I feel like if Red Rum showed up earlier in the movie and it was more mysterious, then again, there's really no mystery. Like,
yeah.
Red Rum, you see it, you know it's murder. Well, but I love it, and I think it's good, and I love the way the kid... Red Rum!
That's fucking scary. Yeah, he did great with that shit.
But just as soon as you see Red Rum, you know, like... I'll put it this way. I wouldn't lose Red Rum. I take that back. The moment where she sees it in the mirror and it says murder and she's shocked, I think that could have been tweaked to be more effective than it was. Because the effect in that comes from the awesome zoom into her face. But in terms of the story, it's just like, you just figuring this out now? That
you're well, like, I don't think that she saw the backwards writing
at yeah, all. That's true.
I think she just looked up and saw murder in the mirror and was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that's true.
Because I was trying to put myself in the
mind. Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm expecting it to be a mystery reveal, and yes. It actually wasn't even intended to be. So I'm judging it
well, wrong. Well, no, I think it was, but think about, put yourself in the shoes of somebody going to the movies back in 1980, you know? And you have, we've been spoiled with, you know, I see dead people and fucking... you know, it was Jigsaw the whole time.
Yeah.
This was that equivalent probably back in 1980, if I could assume, where it's where it's like Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum, like
somebody
so much other like, shit.
Red and
Rum's
like murder backwards, right? And then they all laugh, and then when it happens, they go,
right? Yeah. And okay. Like Kubrick could easily be doing a sleight of hand where it's like distracting with a bunch of other shit. And
yeah.
That's why I think that if he were to milk it in the beginning and then it come back.
It would be like overdone.
It'd be overdone. But the fact that he truncates it so much and he repeats it until it's no longer a word.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, what's that called?
He
like,
oversaturates.
Misophonia. What's it called when you say a
word call
so
it,
much?
I call it vertigo.
I love it. Vertigo, yeah. Where you say it so much that it seems like it seems nonsensical. Yeah.
And so the fact that he puts the audience through that and then the reveal, that's how I interpreted that at the moment.
I dig it. Yeah. You've sold me on it. Cool. Because again, like I say, like I do think the movie's perfect. I wouldn't necessarily change that. But I always try to ask myself when I see a movie, like, if you hate a movie, find one thing you like about it. If you love a movie, find one thing you don't. I think that's just a good rule to have. And so
Fast X
would be
the best movie that's ever
that's
been
done. Yeah, right. That's the one area of the movie that I think in the moment I tend to have a slight eye roll reaction. Yeah. But I think the context is probably pretty clean.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree. But do you have anything like that? Did you think of anything or
no, I mean I'll probably text you in like 2 days, but
we'll put it in the show notes.
This is what I would do.
Do you see any shades of this movie in other movies?
Oh, yeah.
Or does it remind you of any other movies, and can you think of any off
Armageddon.
The top of your head? For real.
No.
Because if you want to take me there, I will go on this journey with you. I will absolutely go on this journey.
Shit. I should have written them down, too, because there was a couple of things in the moment that I was like, oh, that's this, that's this, that's this. There were so many of them that I just didn't.
Well, I can drop two on you.
Yeah, go
that
ahead.
I see. The first one is, have you seen Midsommar?
Hell no.
Okay.
What in our time together would
dude
tell you that I have secretly watched Midsommar
fair
without,
enough.
Without telling you about it?
I ask only as a courtesy. One, I will get you to watch that one day because
I doubt
actually,
it.
I think
doubt
you
it.
Will enjoy it.
You it's, have to trap, here's what you have to do.
It's not.
Here's what you have to do to get me to watch a movie. You will have to do something that you don't like to do, and that is gamble. You're going to have to trap me into a bed somehow, and I will do it because I have a problem, and then I'll watch Midsommar. It's your only option.
Noted.
Yeah. But because you hate gambling so much, I know I'm pretty safe.
I don't
safe.
Hate gambling. I
just you
just
don't, do it.
I'm just not attracted to it, but like I've done it. I will. I'll gamble again before I die.
It will be on Midsommar.
I actually think you would quite enjoy and appreciate Midsommar.
I'm sure I would,
because
but you're gonna have to work
very
for it.
Different from Hereditary. I'll work for it. I think it's worth whatever work I put in. But it reminds me
I do
of,
love Pew though.
This reminds me of Midsommar in such a way that like Florence Pugh's character in that is an extremely, especially in the director's cut, an extremely accommodating partner to the guy that she's dating in the movie. And in the movie, he is somewhat vilified, and correctly so, but also, you know, is I think, given more punishment than his character deserves, purposefully. I think we're supposed to feel that way. But there's a similar dynamic to Wendy and Jack, in that you're watching it as a guy, and you go... And it awakens you to... Because there's been plenty of times, I'm sure, where Jen has been accommodating to me and I'm just being a grump.
Yeah.
And there's no rhyme or reason behind it. And it's just, if I was a third person in the room, I'd be like, can't you see how hard she is working to...
You dumb
to
fuck.
To make everything better and easier for you, and you just can't see it? And Midsommar has a lot of that, and I think that it uses a lot of the same framing and a lot of the same... conversational ping pong that they do, that you get this. I do think they were tapping into The Shining in creating this, like, dude, she just wants to make you a sandwich.
Yeah.
As stereotypical as it comes, bitch, make me a sandwich. Here's a lady who is offering you a sandwich and you will not have it.
Not only that, but you're like berating her.
Yeah, you're being a dick about it.
Yeah.
And so that.
It's
that
so easy
to
say,
to
no,
surface.
Thank you. I just need a few.
Yeah,
just to get this done.
When I'm working in this room, you stay the fuck out of here.
And why don't you start now by getting the fuck out
of here? And so, like,
are you out of your goddamn mind?
That's the best part of the whole movie, because it's like you were literally talking to a ghost bartender up until this very moment. If one person is out of their fucking mind, it's
but like
it's,
the pregnant pause when she's like, Jack, there's somebody else in the hotel.
They tried to strangle Daddy. Are you out?
Wait,
of
wait, 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 wait. are you out of your goddamn mind? Like, the pause is what makes it for me.
Because it's like, you gotta be crazy.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you were literally talking to a long-dead bartender and drinking pretend beer. Or pretend whiskey, sorry.
Also, by the way, Jack Daniels is not bourbon.
No. It's Tennessee rye whiskey. Right? Yeah. And so, But
was that a mistake or was that on purpose? Because I don't see what purpose that would serve.
Yeah, he's just a drunk. But I saw a lot of, like, I think, you know, most men are supposed to watch Midsommar and see a little bit of themselves and recognize when they're being a grumpy, you know, closed off guy.
Toxic masculine.
And I think that they tapped into that from The Shining. The other movie that I would say I see shades of The Shining in is the aforementioned It Follows. And namely in that it is very much trying to be ambiguous to drive themes home. There are a million plot questions in It Follows that don't get to be answered, and the movie's stronger because of it. But visually, it is a movie that, despite being of the modern digital era, cinematographer Mike Gelakis, I want to say his name is, makes it like high art out of widescreen digital photography, the same way that Alcott and Kubrick made high art out of their set pieces. And It Follows is locations, sets, not blue screening or anything, or at least not leaning on blue screen. There might be fill-ins here that I don't know to see. But those are the two movies. And they're actually probably, I would say, the two downright best horror movies since The Shining, if you were to ask me. Or, you know, as much as this term is stupid, they're like elevated horror, as they say.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, the thing is, I do get why people say elevated horror, because, like, there is a difference between Midsommar and Friday the 13th Part 6.
Yeah.
You know, they're both horror movies, but
one's in space.
One's titties and blood, and the other one has, like, higher aspirations. Both equally valid, and I'm a huge fan of all of them, but, like...
Elevated horror is basically just, like, we want a category in the Oscars.
Yeah, we're trying to do a little bit more than just titillate and shock. And not that there's anything at all wrong with titillating and shocking. My background is Jason Voorhees preparing to kill somebody with a guitar.
That's kick-ass.
And it rocks. I'm thinking about getting it as a tattoo. But yeah, so I think It Follows and Midsommar owe a lot to The Shining for those reasons. But I also don't know if it's just because I think they have similar goals of, like, being a loftier genre entry. Yeah. So those would be the ones that I would say I see it, but...
Do you think horror will ever make an appearance at the Oscars? Even though, disclaimer, we don't give a shit about the Oscars anymore.
I mean, Get Out got Best Screenplay.
Oh, it did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, Silence of the Lambs won Best Picture.
Get Out wasn't a horror movie, in my opinion.
It's not a horror movie.
It was like a...
Would you call it an elevated horror?
Societal thriller.
But it's in the realm of a body snatcher's tale.
But you know what I mean? Like, do you think that horror will have a seat at the table for awards moving forward after things like A24 making big strides?
I think it will. I don't even know personally, and this is my controversial take, I don't know that it should. Because there is a place for it. Like I said, Silence of the Lambs won Best Picture. And that is, in a lot of respects, a horror movie. You know, is a Halloween movie ever? No.
But you could also argue that Silence of the Lambs is like a gory detective movie.
It's a procedural And so, like, but, like, you know, it's starting to creep its way in, you know, through things like Get Out winning screenplay, you know, Nope getting nominations for, I think, maybe screenplay, maybe director. I don't remember. There are going to be things that go in. I don't think we're going to see, you know, like a slasher movie making it to the Oscars. It's not going to happen. But, like, personally, I kind of like that horror separate. Whereas the argument is like, hey, horror is as valid a piece of the overall art that is film, which is what the Academy of Motion Pictures and Sciences is supposed to be talking about. Hence the argument for a stunt category. That is part of the art.
Which I'm all for.
And all for. And I think that horror does deserve a seat at that table. I just don't care for the brand of table that the Oscars really is. And I kind of like, I remember as a kid, my dad rented the Wishmaster movie, a movie that I love to this day.
You know what?
Wishmaster, As You Wish.
I got that confused with Pagemaster.
Which is also
a great movie.
Don't play those for opposite audiences, you'll freak out. But my mom walked in the room during a crazy scene in Wishmaster where just like shit's going down. And my mom was like, oh my God, what are you watching? And my dad said something that stuck with me. He goes, it's a creature feature. And I like that horror has the shield of, this is low class, fuck off.
Yeah.
And as much as I think it would be valid to include it in the Oscars, and things like The Shining could, I kind of like the shield of just like, dude, this is gonna be fucking crazy. Don't try to put your art shit on me.
Yeah.
This is it. There's a lot of art here, and you know, but it's a creature feature. Leave me alone. Like, I like the shield that provides in being a genre effort.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, there's the Fangoria Chainsaw Awards that honors the best in horror every year because there's such a wide expanse of what is horror. You know, there's so many different award shows. The Oscars being the be-all, end-all. Hand job motion is what I just did. You know, so I do think that those things will end up there, and I'm supportive of it. But if a horror movie never gets an Oscar again, I do not give a shit.
Let's make our own award show called the Sylvesters.
Ooh. Yeah. Well, at the Philadelphia Film Festival, which you'll hear a bonus episode in the near future, I will be seeing Sly, the documentary about Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, my God.
Which we should nominate for a Sylvester award.
Well, it's going to win. The first one. It's got to.
I want to make an award called The Mosties. And what it is whatever movie has won the most awards. And so then they automatically, their record goes up by one when they win the most. It's like, and tonight's Mosties go to, it's like, oh, Titanic won 13 awards.
Damn.
And their way, it's quantifiable. There's no judgment involved. It's just, did you win the most? Well, you get the Mostie.
Here you go. Like, oh, it's like, a three-way tie between
you won 13 Silence awards the for the Mosties. I mean... 14 awards. Here's your Mostie. And James Cameron's like, thank you the most.
So Silence of the Lambs, Titanic, and Return of the King just constantly get one award every year.
They keep winning, yeah. And then there's no beating them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until they're up to like, 35 apiece.
We did the newbies, which is when we relitigate old awards and then potentially like, oh shit, The English Patient is out, motherfucker.
Baby Geniuses 2, coming to the stage.
The Mosties. Boom, Baby Geniuses. Directed by Bob Clark, a horror director, did Black Christmas.
That movie was scary.
And A Christmas Story, which was not scary. But yeah. I have nothing else on The Shining. I got nothing else. Do you have anything?
Either, yeah.
All right, well then we will just...
We've shined our light.
Shine a light. I was going to ask what your favorite Stephen King book or adaptation is, but is that a question you can answer?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Let me think about it. Do your plugs.
My favorite Stephen King book, I'll say.
Oh, books?
My favorite Stephen King book...
With words?
Yes.
Oh.
Is either 11-22-63, which was made into a series that I haven't watched.
With James Franco.
James Franco. Or Misery, which is probably my favorite Stephen King book, and it also might be my favorite Stephen King movie adaptation. Misery's pretty fantastic.
I'm just going to look up Stephen King movies.
Cool.
Because...
While you do that, I'm going to skip the books. So, you can find everything I do at scullyvision.com. You can find this and all of I Like to Movie Movie at Movie Movie Cast on all of the things. You can check out our other show, Hot Property, at Hot Property Pod on all of the things. So we will have another Hot Property dropping a week from the day this drops. 1 week after that, we are taking a break from this little Halloween excursion that we're doing, and I will be dropping an episode covering all of the things that I see at this year's Philadelphia Film Festival, my final film festival of the year. So definitely check that out. There's a lot of good stuff that's going to be playing. I hope to catch as much of it as possible. And then after that, we will be hitting you with the follow-up to the Shining episode covering Dr. Sleep. So, did you do some research?
Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, Shawshank. That's great.
But horror-wise, I'm going to go with The Mist, because that movie was
also awesome. Darabont. Yeah. Same as Shawshank Redemption. The Mist is incredible.
That movie fucked me up.
Yeah.
Real bad.
And have you read the short story, The Mist?
I think I did, because it was... Why did I say that in the British?
I think I did.
I
read The Mist back in the day.
I think because it was... playing while I was working at the theater back in the day, so I like looked it up on my computer and read it while I was at work.
Yeah, because it's a quick read. It's like an 80-pager novella kind of thing.
Not really. It was the one book I read.
It's at the beginning of one of his short story collections as the novella that kicks it off. The Mist is notable because the ending of The Mist that everybody remembers movie, that's... No, oh. King loves that.
No, it was Tom...
Tom Jane is pissed.
Tom Jane is pissed because The Mist...
What if at the end when he's...
Ended his tryst with his companions.
And it says the end and it says Mist, but then like the M fades away and a P pops up. It's just pissed. No, but Stephen King was like, Darabont put the ending on that movie that I didn't have the balls to put in the book. Like, he likes that added ending.
What's the ending of the story?
The ending of the book is they're all in the car, and there's just monsters everywhere, and they just go like, I think the world's a different place now, let's just drive till we run out of gas, and that's it. And it's just...
Oh, man.
They don't know.
Man, the ending of the movie is so much worse.
The ending of the movie is, yeah, he kills everybody in mercy, and then immediately the problem is solved,
yeah,
and he's alone and in grief. But yeah, like, that's Stephen King apparently was just like, yeah, I didn't have the balls to do that. That ending rules. And so I love that he's a fan.
Well, speaking of ending...
Let's end it. Do you have anything you want to plug?
No.
Cool.
You did it all. You got Hot Property, right?
Hot Property. BB8_thecorgi.
Tiny URL.
Oh, yeah, we have merch. tinyurl.com/hotpropshop for all things Hot Property.
We completely missed the opportunity of being a person to do some things that we can't do over the internet. And one of those things is sing a song together.
Oh, yeah, we can sing a song.
Can we sing our way out?
Yeah, what do we want to sing?
I think we're just going to shine a light.
Shine a light. Well, that's Philadelphia Freedom.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
So we're in Philadelphia.
Should we just...
we'll end on Philadelphia.
Do we want to start at the beginning?
No.
Just be a rolling stone.
Just do a quick...
So, Philadelphia Freedom. Shine a light. What part are we going to do?
Shine a light. Ready?
Yeah.
Shine a light. Shine a light. Shine a light. Gotta shine a light.
Philadelphia Freedom.
All right.
Love, yes, I do. All right,
that's been a movie.
Bye.